Welcome, everyone. I'm Richard Krause. I hope you're doing well, staying happy, healthy, and safe. It's a big show, so let's get right at it. Later on, we'll meet Tassie Cameron. Tassie is an award-winning screenwriter who was the head writer and executive producer on the series Rookie Blue and creator of the show Pretty Hard Cases. Today, we're talking about her latest gig as the producer of Law & Order Toronto Criminal Intent. We talk about the show and what it takes to, quote, unquote, play a dead body on the legendary franchise. That's a little bit later on. First, let's get to know Phil Heath. Fans of bodybuilding will recognize his name as a 7-time Mr. Olympia winner, having won the competition every year from 2011 to 2017. His incredible athletic career was slowed by health concerns, but his strength of character and intensity is captured in a new film co-produced by Dwayne Johnson, Breaking Olympia, The Phil Heath Story, which is now available on Super Channel. It's the untold story of how he battled back from injury in his quest to become the greatest of all time. Phil Heath joined me via Zoom from his home in Los Angeles. Congratulations on the film.
No, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a long time coming. I'm so excited.
Tell me what it's like to sit and look at your film about your life. Is it like going through a scrapbook for the rest of us that don't have movies about our lives?
Yeah, it actually is. When I was presented this project by Adam Scorgi and Brett Harvey, I was just like amazed at the fact that they did so much research mm-hmm. on me. And it definitely took me down a trip, you know, memory lane, you know, as we started to compile data and all the pictures. I mean, from my childhood to high school. I mean, I haven't been in high school in forever. So it was just really, really cool.
You are quite vulnerable in this film as well. I think after watching the film, I feel like I really got a true picture of you. Tell me a little bit about that, because as someone who is so well known for their physique and being strong and being competitive and all that sort of thing, there are moments in this movie which show a softer side of you. Were you reluctant at all to share those moments?
You know, at first I was, because, you know, I've been involved in different projects, and also, you know, I've been a part of the media, you know, being interviewed, you know, for a very long time. And I've mm-hmm. seen like how different agendas and narratives could be created. And, you know, in the world of social media as well, I mean, it's very difficult, because once you put things out there, there's one thing to be transparent, another thing to be vulnerable, because when we're vulnerable, we could be attacked. Mm-hmm. But I believe that the intention with, you know, Brett and Adam and team collectively made me feel that comfort to where I could be extremely vulnerable. And I thought, you know what, for once in my life, I'm going to just give it all. And just to allow people to see what's in, not just inside here with the mental fortitude of becoming a champion, but what's inside, you know, the pain points, the real pain points that may deliver someone else through their, you know, darkness.
Well, you talk about depression in this film. There are a couple of points in your life, at least, I think, that you have felt that way. And I do think that it's helpful to put those stories out there for other people who are feeling in a similar way, like things are never going to work out, like my life is over, you know, whatever it might be. But to see someone like you not only persevere, but get over those humps, I think is incredibly important.
Absolutely. I mean, the goal is to remind everybody that you're not alone. Mm-hmm. You know, there's other people that have gone through maybe similar, maybe not as the exact same, because I do believe we're all one of one. But to know that there's light, real light at the end of the tunnel, but realizing within that light, it's actually inside us. Mm-hmm. We have to discover the light within us to get through, to navigate, you know, through that darkness and to continue to have hope. Because without hope, I mean, it's very, very difficult.
You've always been very driven. We get that impression in the film. But when was it that you realized that, what you just said, that we, you know, when you started thinking about things a little differently and started thinking about sort of bigger picture outside of yourself issues and that kind of thing?
I definitely feel like it came to a point where I had to sit still mm. and to not hyper-focused on something that's negative in the present time, but think about the things that I already have overcome. And to kind of, you know, think of myself as like a hero in my own story of life. What would the movie really look like, so to speak? You know, I'm the lead character in this, and I actually have the ability to change my outcome. And how did this athlete change his outcome? How did Michael Jordan go through the things that he went through? How did, you know, Brett Favre, you know, find out that his dad died and still throw those touchdowns, still stay focused, you know? And then what about, you know, my parents? I'm sure they went through all kinds of hell, you know, just to, you know, growing up during the civil rights movement in the Deep South. You know, I'm not alone, man. And what's on the other side of pain? Triumph. And I must have that moment. And the last thing I wanted to do is just give up on myself, because I'd also be giving up on all of the people, not just my parents, but those coaches, those friends, those people that, you know, said good job, even as a youngster.
You're listening to Phil Heath on The Richard Krause Show. The film about his life, Breaking Olympia, The Phil Heath Story, is now available on Super Channel.
You know, those people that poured into me as if that those things never mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I need to leverage those moments and to propel me, you know, over the obstacles that are facing me at that present time.
Let's talk about the sport of bodybuilding. It's interesting to me that the really hard work happens when no one's looking. Your coach is looking, maybe a few other people in the gym, but all the stuff where you have to eat seven times a day, and we'll talk about that in a sec, and the workouts and all that kind of thing leads you to a moment on the stage, which is very impressive, but that's not the hard part from what I understand.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everyone has an emotional attachment to food. Everyone has an emotional attachment to even maybe whether it be cigarettes, maybe it's alcohol, whatever it is. But to become a bodybuilder, it can't just be, oh, I'm just going to try this. There's no dabbling in this. Like, you are all in. And it requires you to do it every day, but also every hour.
Mm.
So you have to lead with a great amount of intention and recognize that other sports, although they're impressive and they have their own levels of discipline, bodybuilding is something that you have to eat a certain way. You have to train a certain way. You have to sleep a certain way. You have to recover a certain way. Everything matters. So I thought, man, like, if I'm going to be a bodybuilder, I cannot not necessarily be a rock star at the same time. I tried that initially. I thought, oh man, like when I won my first contest, I was like, oh man, let's go party afterwards. And it's like, yeah, that's not a good idea, because the next day my body did not look like it previously did. So all that hard work can go away just like that. And it's really not worth it in the end. And it allowed me to realize, man, I truly value myself in a different way. I now set some standards, some boundaries, even with friends and family, to say, hey, look, I can't necessarily go out partying with you guys. I got a contest. And you teach people how you want to be treated through that process.
I imagine that even just going out and having like two beers not only makes you look a little different, but makes mm-hmm. you feel different. It's a mental thing, and probably, I would guess, a physical thing as well.
100%. You know, it's not like I've never had those moments where I wanted a beer, or I have a liquor cabinet in my house. I just know when they say in moderation, I know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, even with going out for pizza and burgers and fries and stuff like that, especially, you know, I was living in Colorado during the great years of the Denver Broncos winning. I'm like, man, let's go in the Avalanche. Let's go, you know, and you're saying, you know what? Yeah, let's go to the game, and let's also go eat healthy before the game and then after the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was somewhat difficult, again, like trying to convince a lot of my close friends that this is what I really want. And I think once they were able to see the transformation and how it made me look and how it made me feel, they too started realizing, oh, maybe I should be a little bit more mindful, right? So, you know, I definitely believe that pouring into myself allowed my friends to do the same.
Tell me about the difficulty of eating seven times a day. It's detailed in the movie. They talk about it in the film. And I don't know, from where I sit, I think I agree with a lot of people. It can't be that hard, but it is. It's a difficult thing that you found, partially because of schedule, but just physically it wears on you.
Absolutely. A lot of people could say that, and a lot of people could say they could train 6 days a week, and they probably couldn't for years on end. When it comes to the diet, to have a structured diet, not just, oh, well, he eats chicken breast. Why eat chicken breast? It's like, no, you're actually eating a certain amount of grams of protein per meal. For me, it was like 70, 75 grams of protein per meal, anywhere from 35 to 50, maybe sometimes 60 grams of carbs per meal. You start doing that over a course of just 1 week, including like drinking 2 gallons of water a day, making sure you're getting enough fiber. Your jaws are going to start hurting from eating so much, and then still having to carry on with your normal day. So the eating aspect of competition bodybuilding, competitive bodybuilding, is like no other. I mean, it is a job.
Yeah.
And the reason why I know a lot of people would find it very difficult is they would have to give up other foods that are, you know, not as tasty. You know, like you can't use a lot of different sauces and stuff like that. Some of it can be bland at times, and it's, you know, you try to have a little bit of variety, but it is a job like no other. It is something that even right now, as I think about it, I'm like, gosh damn, I ate all those meals. I mean, literally thousands of meals, thousands, you know. And I guess the great part about it is that, you know, the proof was in my performance,
right?
You know, I had something to show for it.
Because you're not eating for enjoyment. I guess maybe that's it. It's fuel. Yeah. It is, you're eating to do a very specific thing to your body. You're not thinking, man, that tastes great. You're thinking, this is what's going to work for me. So that's part of the equation, the enjoyment part taken away from food. So it's real work.
Oh, yeah. And I can't say that it wasn't enjoyable to have a nice steak. I'm not going to sit here and say that. But when you have to do it over and over again, yeah, and there is no compromise, there is no, oh, well, you know, I'm not really hungry, I'll go do it later. It's like, no, you have to. Every 2.5 hours, you are eating. So that means you have to schedule your whole life around eating. Yeah. You would think it would be scheduling a life around just training. Training is only for an hour, maybe two, you know, and then you throw some cardio in. But eating is every 2.5 hours. It's nuts.
And it's interesting to see you in the movie, and we see part of the training, and we talk about it, that sort of thing. You're kind of on the other side of it now a little bit. You're still in very good shape, but you're not in that. You're not doing that kind of thing anymore. Do you miss it?
You know, I do. I do miss the competitions. I do miss being on stage with my, you know, fellow competitors. I do miss that part. Of course, I miss beating a lot of these guys. You know, that was always fun too, because through competition, you get to see yourself.
Yeah.
You get to see your hard work be rewarded in that aspect. But, you know, I'll always be a bodybuilder. I will always take what I've earned and what I've learned, you know, on how to stay committed to a diet, how I can change my training style over the years, how I learn how to recover from injury, you know, and how I learn how to really love myself through dark moments, and to continuously thank my body each and every day when I wake up. You know, that is the biggest thing that I think a lot of people forget, is that we wake up and we grab our phone. The first thing we do is grab our phone. It's like, can you just sit back and just be like, I am alive. I have so much opportunity. And it's not BS. It's like, you have everything at your disposal, all these new resources. And, you know, for me, I'm always going to be a fan of the sport of bodybuilding. I wish all the men and women in our industry, you know, great luck and success. But yeah, it does. Every so often I'm in that gym and I'm like, man.
Well, you talk about having respect for your body and being grateful for your body, even though in a certain way, your body kind of betrayed you in the sense of the hernia, which turned into something more and affected the way that you lived and the way that you competed and all that sort of thing. But you say in the movie, and I wrote down the quote, you say in the movie that the rehab on the body that you had to do was nothing compared to the rehab that you had to do in your brain and in your heart as well. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, when you're training for these contests, you know, you're expecting your body to perform at a very high level because you're fueling it. But what you're not realizing is that sometimes injuries come. You're not immune to that. You try to be through all of the recovery and all that stuff, but you know, things happen. And with that, you know, I was sidelined and, you know, I was very disappointed because I wanted it so bad and I was so close. And I knew, and the competitors knew, the critics knew, you know, the journalists knew, if Phil Heath is in his best form, there is no one ever going to take him down. And I felt like, yeah, if I had never got injured, maybe I'd still be competing. But I do feel like when they say Father Time is undefeated, I don't know if it's the time. I just feel like your body will let you know, okay, it's you've pushed me to the limit. And I know you have an iron will. I know you have a, you know, all this great grit, but I'm going to tap out right now. And that was very, very difficult. I had to remind myself that, you know, life isn't always fair. And there's a thing that I can learn through this time. And I felt like I got that time out from above that said, Phil, I just need you to sit here and to understand that there's a lesson to be learned on how life can be outside of the sport.
You're listening to Phil Heath on The Richard Krause Show. The film about his life, Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story, is now available on Super Channel.
And it, with me and Breaking Olympia coming back in 2020 during freaking COVID.
I know.
That, I felt, produced a different level of commitment, different level of understanding, but overall a different level of love to myself of saying, you're going for this title, but whether you win it or lose it, it's going to feel amazing to be back up there, to give it everything you got. And look, I didn't peak for that contest. And it was literally the first time in my career that I didn't peak, but I still smiled on that stage. I still enjoyed those moments with my fellow competitors, took pictures backstage, you know, with guys, with the younger guys, you know, and just really had a ball. And I'm glad that I ended it the way I did. Like I said in the film, I was third in 2008 and I was third in 2020 and I won a few titles in between, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, it's really awesome that, you know, I could exit the way that I did.
And this film is a document of that legacy. And I was wondering, as I was watching it, I know that you had at least two copies of Pumping Iron that were very important to you. But were there other films? And I know Arnold Schwarzenegger, obviously, and there's a lot of names that come up in the film. But were there movies that really struck a chord with you and have stayed with you while you were on your bodybuilding journey?
Anything that have to do with an athlete going through their own journey of triumph.
Right.
But also like Kobe Bryant Muse was like a film that I would watch because I followed his career a lot and understanding that he was kind of introverted. Like he didn't, you know, he did the interviews, but his relationship with teammates and stuff like that. And I resonated with that because I thought, man, like this guy has social media, but he doesn't use it. He's not like a LeBron James who does use that platform differently. Right. And it's not like one's better than the other. I just knew that I would watch him and I knew that he had that stare that when they said the Black Mamba, I'm like, I totally know what that is, brother. I know what that is. You know, the grit of the teeth and the tenacious, you know, energy that everyone, even if they did not like him, they had to respect him. And even when he was hurt, he showed no weakness. When he tore the Achilles, he showed no weakness. When he had the shoulder, the knee, no weakness. When he got his nose broken, no weakness. And I thought, man, that's like me, like show no weakness. And through that process, I mean, you are hurting, you are able to, at least in the competitive sphere, they don't know. And then when they know later through films like what we have, they're able to see like, wow, he held in a lot. And but yeah, that was definitely a person who I have admired, and yeah, he's sorely missed, but that was the guy that I would say, oh yeah, I'm gonna always watch him.
That was bodybuilder Phil Heath, 7-time Mr. Olympia winner. He had a career almost unparalleled, puts his name up there on the list with people like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Find out all about his storied career in Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath Story, a new documentary now playing on Super Channel. My guest in this segment is Tassie Cameron, television producer and writer of shows like Degrassi, The Next Generation, The 11th Hour, Rookie Blue, and many more. Her latest project is Law and Order Toronto: Criminal Intent, the new adaptation of the legendary Law and Order brand based on the classic series created by Dick Wolf. A psychological thriller wrapped in a criminal investigation, it showcases original Canadian stories written, produced, and starring Canadians. Tassie Cameron joined me to talk about the show, true crime, and what it takes to play a dead body on the show. And here's a hint. It's not what you think. So the obvious question to start with, coming in, were you a Law and Order fan? Because you're speaking to a super fan. So
That's always very intimidating when I'm speaking to a super fan. I wouldn't say that I was a super fan. Law and Order has been in my world and on my television for as long as I can remember. And so it is, I'm steeped in it the same way anybody my age is, and certainly have watched a lot of it in my time. But super fans can stump me probably at every turn. So
We got to the point during the pandemic where we had watched these shows so often that within 10 seconds of starting one, we'd go, oh, this is the one on the casino boat with the thing, and then and move on to the next one. I don't know if I'm proud of that or not, but that's just the way it is.
that's amazing. I feel that it would be hard to do. In some ways, it might be hard to be a super fan and to take on a new franchise of this show. It would be very intimidating, I think,
Well,
if you were like so aware of every episode,
it might be so, right? You're so on the inside of it that no idea would seem new. You'd think to you, oh, well, in season 3, episode 4, they, dot, 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 and we're just copying ourselves. So perhaps being a little bit more on the outside works better for you. But as you told someone here, I think it was Toronto Life, you don't want to be the person who mucked up the Law and Order franchise.
I'm not sure I said mucked, but yeah, no, nobody would want to be that person.
And why so? Do you think that there's just such a love of that show and those characters? And it is remarkable because other than Mariska Hargitay and a small handful of others, actors have come and gone. It's the franchise, it's the structure, it's the show that people love, not necessarily just the actors, which is kind of counterintuitive, I think.
It's very unusual. It's usually the actors are what people keep people coming back, I think. I mean, I think in Mariska's case, she certainly has added to that. But yeah, no, I think the franchise itself is the star of this completely. And I think that there it's such a satisfying thing to watch. It's such a you can drop in and out. You can watch it in any hotel room in any city in any part of the world, like it's and they're very satisfying stories to watch. And so yeah, I think it's they've like landed on this magic formula that just appeals to people.
And there are a number of different formulas. So there is the Law and Order kind of umbrella. And then under that, you've got the traditional Law and Order, 23 minutes of crime and solving the crime, and then the court in the final half hour. Then there's the SVU. Now, what you're doing is the criminal intent version of this, which is a little different. It doesn't take place so much inside a courtroom. It's mostly about the psychological aspects of it. So explain for people who aren't super fans, what that means, what it means to do the criminal intent version.
I mean, as you say, the one of the main differences is it's far less legal than the original Law and Order, like the OG. It goes into the criminal's points of view, which is unusual and quite a challenging thing for the writers of the show, because you're having to do what they call cutaways, four or five cutaways per episode, where you go into the criminal's perspective in some kind of clever way that doesn't give all of the mystery away. And it's more, as you say, psychological. It's the why done it is as important as the who.
You're listening to Tassie Cameron on The Richard Krause Show. Watch Law & Order Toronto Criminal Intent on City TV.
And I find it helpful. It's probably stating the obvious, but I find it helpful to think of it as Sherlock Holmes and Watson, that it's this kind of storytelling that we're digging into as we're proceeding in this particular franchise. And it's not a franchise that's currently on the air except here. So
it's interesting when you look at how these shows are structured. You talk about the cutaways where you are showing the story from the criminal's point of view. I think that's important because at the end of the episode, when the big reveal happens, it can't feel like the audience didn't have a chance to figure it out themselves. You have to have given the audience as much information as possible without spoiling anything. Otherwise, it's just like a trap door opens and up pops somebody and says, I did it. And you've never met me before. So it's tricky to find that balance, I would imagine.
It's very, very tricky. It's very complicated, and as in fact for the writers to figure out how to do that. And you have to, I mean, we're always saying, is that playing fair? Like, we have to play fair with your audience. You have to give them as much of the puzzle as you can, so that when they go back, if they were to go back, that they can go, oh yeah, that was that wallpaper border was in front of me the whole time, or this, you know. You have to play fair, I think, in this particular one. You don't want a trap door of surprises for sure.
At what point, or have you met and or worked with Dick Wolf? Anyone who's watched any of the Law and Orders and most other hour long primetime television in the last 20 years has seen his name pop up at the end, as the creator of Law and Order. Is he involved? Do you consult with him? Is there a Bible that he gives you with all the details that you need? How does it work?
I mean, first of all, this is a fully Canadian show. So it's, you know, it's financed out of Canada. All the writers are Canadian directors, actors. So it is its own independent version of the show. That it's just important to kind of say that it's not like an arm of the American company or anything. The show is owned by Canadians. I have not met Mr. Wolf. I very much look forward to it someday. I have not spoken with him. He watches the cuts, and he gave us one brilliant note on the first episode. And, you know, I mean, we certainly benefit from his incredible team of people who are consulting on this with us. He has a very, very strong team of executives and creative people who have been working with him for a long time. And we have been lucky enough to get to, you know, pick their brains on how to do it, and they give notes on scripts, and along with our Canadian broadcaster and our studio. So, and we were in fact given a Bible. I'm not sure if they called it a Bible or if it was writing guidelines, or, you know, and it was quite a thick document with all the rules of the game for criminal intent. And, you know, and it's interesting because you get this document and you think, well, this is going to be a breeze because they've just told me how to do this.
Yeah.
But then you start kind of going through it and it's like, well, it could be this, or you could do this version of it, or it could be this version. And in fact, it starts to feel like a very complicated puzzle, actually, as much as it is writing a script. And it has to have all that emotional character work and primal motives and all that psychology. But it's also got the kind of, it's like constructing a Swiss watch on some level. It's quite tricky.
So many gears that have to hit the right cogs, otherwise it all just stops. Tell me a little bit about the story ideas for the crimes. We had a crack-smoking mayor in an episode recently. So tell me a little bit about, I guess, that mix of reality where it meets fiction and turns into a script for your show.
Right. It's a great question. I mean, I think it was Dick Wolf himself who said, you know, you steal the headline, not the story. And I think that was a helpful quote to hear early on. If we're not making docudramas, that it would be so boring if we were just telling the exact stories as they occurred in the headline. Everybody would know the ending, and it would be very tedious, I think. So we take headlines that are engaging. We started saying that they've got a kind of stickiness to them, that there's something that sticks to you, that like a detail or a moment, but then we are really, really just inspired by and not at all trying to stick to the true story. We're spinning out in completely different directions every time in order to make sure that the stories are surprising and entertaining. So you're looking for those headlines that people might think, oh, I think I know what this might be about, but then you're trying to surprise and tell a different take on that kind of world or that crime, and not at all lift anything real.
In the crack smoking mayor episode, is that actually City Hall? Did you get a permit to shoot? You're nodding your head yes, because I thought this is not a set. This cannot be a set. How did you get permission to shoot in there?
I don't know. I still am pinching myself on that. I couldn't believe it when they said that. I mean, the City of Toronto has been incredibly cooperative with us. I couldn't believe that we were able to shoot in there. And then Aiden, our lead, goes in and lowers all the counselors' chairs as a prank when he was in there. It's like, oh, great. You're never going to get asked back.
You are a fan of true crime. Did that influence your decision to take on this show in any way?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I love true crime. I love, you know, whether it's podcasts or documentaries or books. My mother and my sister's my partner in our company, and our mother, Stevie Cameron, was a investigative crime journalist. And
I know that. Yeah. I didn't know that was your mother. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So we sort of grew up. She was always going on about the prime minister's latest dirty dealings, or she wrote the kind of definitive book on the Picton pig farm murders.
Yeah, the Robert Picton. Yeah.
So we were always talking about crime at the dinner table, and it, you know, and talking about policing and talking about how people get away with things and why people do what they do. And many of my mom's friends were, you know, psychologists and criminal people.
You're listening to Tassie Cameron on The Richard Krause Show. Watch Law and Order Toronto Criminal Intent on City TV.
So I've definitely been steeped in it since I was little.
I think part of the appeal of true crime, and then, you know, to push it a little further to Law and Order, is that it really is good versus evil. Typically speaking, in true crime, you get an end. Someone gets arrested, they get thrown in jail. There's kind of a almost a comforting thing about it where, well, good, generally speaking, wins. And I think that's the same on Law and Order criminal Intent. Generally speaking, I haven't seen all 10 episodes, but I'm going to assume that, you know, people are generally always arrested and, you know, something that justice prevails at the end. And I think people are comforted by that.
I think they really are. I read this quote and I weirdly have it in front of me, which I didn't plan at all, but crime fiction is a form of moral education, and the detective restores order and upholds justice. And I just thought that was very relevant to what we're trying to do. You know, you get to right the wrongs of a very chaotic and morally unpredictable universe, and you do it in 44 minutes. And most of the time, at least on this show, you get justice, which it certainly doesn't feel like that in the real world most of the time.
Yeah, in an increasingly chaotic world, I am not surprised that true crime has become more and more and more popular. It's the most popular podcast genre. It is something that people can't seem to get enough of. And I think it's just that. I think it restores, for the time you're listening to the podcast or watching the show or reading the book, it restores some kind of order into a world that seems to have gone a little amok.
I think that's true. And I think also it's letting... The newer iterations of true crime are letting the audience, viewer, listener play along. Mm-hmm. And you know, that we're all armchair detectives at this point, and we all are incredibly well-versed in forensics and motive. And I think it's very satisfying to people to be able to kind of bring their knowledge to bear on these shows.
Finally, a question I'm sure you've been asked many times since you took over this gig: how do I get to be a dead body on Law and Order Toronto Criminal Intent?
Well, Richard, we're going to make that happen for you. The weird answer to that is you actually have to be a pretty good actor for the most part, because the dead bodies in Law and Order Criminal Intent are the victims that we have to care about in the tease. Right. So unless you have multiple dead bodies, like we did in our second episode, you actually have to be able to act. But I'm sure you could, and we'll work to get you on there if that's what
listen, you. Listen, it would be the high. I could retire after that. It would be the highlight of everything.
I can't believe how many people want to be dead bodies of all things. It's so interesting. It's so hard being a dead body.
Well, I think it was. I can't remember the actor's name now, who he said, I've been killed. I've made 200 movies and I've been killed in 160 of them. The thing I've learned is that if you're falling, you have to fall in a comfortable way, because you're going to be laying there for hours. So make sure that you're not laying on your arm or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, no, it's, you're laying there for hours with, like, you know, fake blood on your head. And I find it fascinating. I mean, and, you know, truly, when I bring anybody in to tour the set, the first thing everybody wants to do is get on the morgue table, like, and then take my picture, or open up the morgue drawer and get into it. It's just, it's a completely childlike impulse for every single person that tours that set.
Wow. Funny. Well, that's, I mean, I'm not alone then. I'm not alone in my morbid fascination with that.
Not alone at all. And you should come to set and we'll take your photograph on the slab.
I would love it. That was Tassie Cameron on The Richard Krause Show. You can find Law and Order Criminal Intent every week on City TV. Check it out. It's a really cool show. Big thanks to Tassie for coming by. Also, a big thanks to Phil Heath. Find his new movie, Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story, on Super Channel. Of course, as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krause. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay safe, stay weird, and we'll talk to you again soon.